Welcome to The Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature.
You look at how a nematode worm is set up, and you can see that I am a variation on a nematode worm. We are physico-chemical cousins, the worm and I, the hummingbird and the otter, the rose, the elephant, the carrot, and the giraffe.
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
Scientists tell us that concern with the environment will no longer be one of many single issues in the next century. It will move to the center of the stage. It will become the context of everything, of our lives, our businesses, our politics. We are, in fact, moving from the information age to the age of biology. In this series, The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature, we salute the bioneers, the biological pioneers who are working with nature to heal nature, reducing the human footprint, honoring native wisdom, and restoring the earth by changing the world. The idea that human beings developed on a separate track from the rest of life, that we are somehow a special species with superior capabilities, has proven itself a devastating philosophy. This was not the first people's approach to life on Earth. They suggest that we have strayed from the original instructions. Pioneers warn that this widely accepted, self-centered, humans are better than the rest of life idea could lead us to ruin. When did our own reflection become more fascinating than the miracle and the beauty of life around us? Is staring into the mirror of human technology and ingenuity the wisest way to proceed toward the 22nd century? In this program, Stephen Foster, Jeremy Narby, Jennifer Green, Peter Warshaw, Paul Stamets, and Terry Tempest Williams turn Narcissus' mirror away for a moment and help us look up from species-wide self-absorption to gaze in awe as we explore Gaian wonders of the co-evolutionary dance. My name is Michael Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
One of the things I want you to do this morning is find a way to question your own assumptions about your own thought processes.
Stephen Foster has served as a medicinal and aromatic plant specialist for more than 20 years. The author of many books, including Herbs for Your Health and Herbal Renaissance, he is president of Stephen Foster Group, Incorporated, a consulting firm serving the medicinal and aromatic plant industries. He spoke at a recent Bioneers conference.
It happened to me about 20 years ago, a little event in the woods. I've lived in Arkansas for over 20 years. I moved there. I had a job offer to start an herb school when I was 22 years old, and it turned out not to be real. So I ended up stuck in Arkansas with no job, no money, no car. I found a cabin to live in about a mile in the woods, and lived there alone for 2 years, and it turned out to be one of the most valuable experiences of my life. And so I would spend about half the day writing and about half the day walking in the woods. And there was a favorite little spot I used to go to. There was just a little tiny permanent pool of water there with snail darters, nice little waterfall when it was raining, and a lovely dogwood hanging over this little pool of water, and I used to go there and sit. And, you know, after doing this for a couple of years, I felt like I was pretty in touch with nature. But beneath all that was this subconscious human assumption that we had dominion over the plants and the earth, and, you know, I didn't think I thought that, but a dragonfly landed on a branch in front of me, and so I was sitting there communing with nature, and I started looking at the dragonfly. And we started staring into each other's eyes. And this went on for several minutes. And then the dragonfly took its two front legs and put them on either side of its head and turned its head 180 degrees, came back to center, and turned it around the other way. And that single experience that single experience made me realize that I had to question every assumption that I had in my mind.
Stephen Foster.
Molecular biology is a great way for understanding just how interconnected we all are.
Jeremy Narby is an anthropologist whose book, The Cosmic Serpent, looks at how consciousness and intelligence came into being. For 10 years, he explored the Amazonian rainforests, the libraries of Europe, and scientific journals to show that DNA and the life it codes for at the cellular level may possess mind qualities, a belief shared by Amazonian shamans. Here, he paints a vivid picture of our kinship with all life.
If you just look into the human biology of the being a walking cell bag, excuse my reductionism, and, just the fantastic, just how wonderful it is that I was one cell, a fertilized egg, and then this diversified into 250 different cell types, and then it set it up in the form that it's in with a nicely wired brain, and, and it self-repairs itself, and all these 100,000 billion cells sending each other signals and committing suicide sometimes to be replaced when sunburn happens, and, setting themselves up to be the being that I am in a kind of constant form. It's fantastically interesting. And then you look at how a nematode worm, which has 959 cells, is set up, and you can see that this is just a variation. I am a variation on a nematode worm. It has a mouth, a digestive tract, 300 neurons, and a cuticle, and its cells are sending each other the same signals that my cells are. We are physico-chemical cousins, the worm and I, the hummingbird and the otter, the rose, the elephant, the carrot, and the giraffe. We are family, including the anaerobic bacteria that are living at the volcano vents at the bottom of the ocean. This whole biospheric, organic thing that surrounds the molten rock, which is the planet, and gives it air and blueness and breathability and constant temperature. It's just a fantastic thing. And you can actually get your mind blown just by understanding the science of, the biology of our beings and of the biosphere.
Jeremy Narby.
It transforms substances in evaporation. It condenses. It divides. It provides the possibility of life itself.
Remember as a child squatting down and gazing with endless fascination into a mud puddle after a summer rain? Jennifer Green never lost her sense of wonder. A founding member of the Water Research Institute of Blue Hill and Water Forms Incorporated, she has established the only drop picture laboratory in the United States. Combining her research with sculpture, Green creates beautiful flow forms that purify water. Her laboratory, located in Maine, doubles as a theater for watching water drops.
When a drop hangs on Earth, it is pulled down by gravity. When it hangs in space, it is fully spherical and absolutely round. And about 15 missions ago on the space shuttle, they did some very interesting experiments with large, huge drops. I mean, big-time huge drops. Big drops that they were able to form. And on the surface, they were astounded at what they observed. All these forms and ordered chaos forms, vortices, and it was astonishing. And a drop is an extraordinary thing. It's a layer upon layer upon layer upon layer upon layer upon layer, and I can go on upon layer of itself, so thin that it cannot be measured. And if you were to peel a drop like you would an onion and lay it out contiguously, one layer after another, on the front ground, it would cover half an acre, one drop, half an acre of area. So here we have a drop and drops composed of layers of itself, all the time shimmering and moving and turning, with this very interesting layer on the outside which holds the whole thing together, we think. Surface tension. You can't see it, you can only see the effects of it. And there's nothing that gets us quite as excited as sitting around wondering what that outside layer is, in fact, because it's quite different. There are many ways that water is the midwife to life and serves it. For instance, water drops in temperature and becomes more dense as the temperature drops, denser and denser and denser until at 4 degrees centigrade, not zero, but at 4 degrees centigrade, it is at this most dense point. And then as the temperature continues to drop, the whole thing lightens up, expands, and freezes. Ice, therefore, floats. But look at the dynamic. You have the sinking temperature, this densification, and as if wrested from death, it expands and is lifted out again. Therefore, we do not have the wasteland that we otherwise would have. A wonderful example of water serving life. The temperature at which water accepts chemical change and different substances most easily is 37 degrees centigrade, which is the body temperature of the human being. We don't find life in clouds. We don't find much at all in ice. There are some bacteria. We don't find a great deal in steam, but we find life in the liquid element.
Jennifer Green.
What's interesting is that because our eye is the same salt concentration as the ocean, we have kept the ocean in our eyeball. And so we filter the light waves like we do the sun in the same way that life began.
And we're looking through water.
Yeah, like you're looking through. You are. You're literally, your retina is looking through water.
We are looking through water that has the same salinity as the ocean from which we once emerged. The temperature at which water accepts chemical change, where it most easily merges with another substance, is the same temperature as the body temperature of the human being. How does this happen? It's the coevolutionary dance. Peter Warshaw is a world-renowned water steward, biodiversity and wildlife specialist, and research scientist who is currently editing Whole Earth, the magazine of the Whole Earth Catalog. He spoke with producer Neil Harvey.
The Earth has been around for 4 billion years, and all the atmosphere and the sounds and the sun and the rocks and the soil have all co-evolved together. And it's always been assumed that they co-evolved in this Darwinian survival for the fittest kind of manner. Recently, there's been more study of how things have kind of cooperated as they've evolved, and that we've realized more and more that we're all on the same stage. And no one has really looked at the stage in a way in which the drama of life takes place.
We co-evolve. There's co-evolution going on here.
Yeah.
And the bee sees, you know, these multifaceted patterns in a white flower, to us as a white flower. Mm-hmm. Now, those patterns that the bee sees, are they there because bees can see that? Somehow the bee has drawn those colors.
This has a lot to do with, and everyone feels it, the kind of the relation of art and sex. You know, that art is sexy or sex is beautiful or something like that. And what the bee, of course, is doing is it's going to get nectar or pollen to feed its hive. But what the flower is doing is tricking the bee into coming into the flower, onto the landing platform, into the place where the nectar is in a very specific way. It's designed itself. It co-evolved with the bee so that when the bee enters, the pollen will be spread all over the bee's body or onto its legs so that when the bee visits the next flower, it'll pollinate it. The ultimate in co-evolution are certain orchids. And the orchids are kind of like sex bombs. And then they evolve to look just like the female insect. So if you kind of squint your eyes on certain orchids and you look at them, you'll see those two little petals kind of look like wings sticking out, and the bottom part looks like the belly of a wasp or another kind of bee. And if you just kind of let your imagination go, because this is the Jane Mansfield, this is the Marilyn Monroe for the insect, like a honeybee, or actually most of them are very specific bees because they just love this particular image of this particular kind of flower, and they'll go mate with it. And then the flower, and again in its wily coyote ways, has arranged the flower so that when the insect is mating with it, it transfers the pollen exactly onto the insect, into a particular part of the insect, and then the insect goes and mates with another one of these flowers, and it gets... transferred. So that's what we mean by coevolution. I mean, it's very tight. Orchids are probably one of the tightest of all that. But in general, it kind of infuses everything that happens, and the attractiveness of living creatures to each other. I mean, we get the perks, in a way, if you want to say it, of flowers being attractive to beetles and other insects. But because we share, that's the crucial point, is because we share that same aesthetic, the flower looks beautiful to us.
Peter Warshaw, the editor of Whole Earth. Most of us have heard, the flower adapts to attract the silicon eye of pollinating insects. Trees spread seeds via the appetites of birds and squirrels. The deer develops speed proportional to the sharpness of the wolf's tooth. These pioneers say, the nematode worm is my cousin, and though hard to imagine, we are related to carrots. When we return, a subterranean introduction to our mushroom dance partners from Paul Stamets, and then a Gaian baptism as we continue our exploration of Gaian wonders of the coevolutionary dance. My name is Michael Toms. You're listening to The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature. Paul Stamets is a mycotechnologist extraordinaire. His books include The Mushroom Cultivator and Growing Gourmet and Medicinal Mushrooms. He is president of Fungi Perfecti, a mail-order business supplying cultures and mycotechnologies to mushroom cultivators throughout the world. Like Stephen Foster, Jeremy Narby, Jennifer Green, and Peter Warshaw, Paul Stamets has never lost his childlike enthusiasm for Gaia's wonders. The mycelial mats he refers to are an underground life stage of mushrooms everywhere. He spoke to a Bioneers conference audience.
Throughout the world, on every landmass, there are mosaics of overlapping mycelial mats that are coursing underfoot. The complexity of these mycelial mats is the basis of our food web. It is the basis of the food chain. Unless we can recycle these nutrients, all ecological systems in the world will collapse. As the mycelium moves silently but quickly, these things are moving 2 to 4 inches a day, so they're actually moving quite aggressively. As the mycelium courses through the environment, it picks up information, you know, about what needs to be repaired, what needs to be recycled, etc. And so, seemingly undifferentiated, I believe that the mushroom mycelium is intelligent. It is sentient. It is pervasive. With more than a mile cells in a cubic inch, with overlapping mycelial networks, by definition, they would have to be. 465 million years ago, plants and fungi first joined together and came onto land. 90% of all plants have fungal associates, many of them mushrooms. All grasses have fungal associates. The basis of our biology is that of community. We depend upon each other, and we have to use each other's resources in order to survive. We also share 30% of our DNA in common with fungi. 100 to 200 million years later, after 465 million years ago, our common heritage with fungi diverge. We respire, we respire carbon dioxide, so do the fungi. But this duality of existence between plants, fungi, and animals is the entire basis of our existence. The oldest living organism in the world is a fungus. Recently, another one found in Washington State, 2,300 years of age, 2,200 acres. The biomass, or mycomass, is literally into hundreds of thousands of tons. And these things exist for a purpose. It is, I think, absolutely ridiculous to think that these things are not intelligent. They've existed as long as we have. They interact with the environment in a different way. We are actually gathering from our ancient past and pulling out those models which will help us survive. And I think the planet is calling out to us and saying, we have to build community, you have to understand the role of other organisms within our environment and join an alliance with them. The research you'll see here has led to a patent that is huge, absolutely huge in its implications. It's the most powerful thing that I could possibly communicate to all of you, and it's the fastest remedy for helping to heal the planet. And the good news is this happens quickly. This doesn't take years. This takes weeks and months. So the mushroom mycelium did something that we know no one had ever reported this before. This is the mushroom mycelium, and this is E. coli that spread over a petri dish. And as the mushroom mycelium grows out and encounters E. coli, then the center of the mycelium, the mother mat of the mycelium, because of biochemical triggers, we don't know exactly how, but as the mycelium grows out and encounters the E. coli, acids and enzymes are being produced, and then it sends out a group of messenger crystals, these pyramidal crystalline entities that advance on an osmotic pressure wave, and as they encounter the E. coli, they disintegrate. And as they disintegrate, it sends back a chemical signature information back to the mother mycelium, which then produces a secondary crystal, a large macro crystal, which then becomes like a strange attractant to the E. coli. And here you have literally thousands of E. coli that are stunned now. They're no longer motile. They're stunned. They collect around these strange unknown crystals. We have some idea what they are, but we haven't typed them fully. It stuns them, and then the mycelium advances and consumes them. So we have developed a mycelial mass for throwing into sensitive watersheds that will collect the E. coli and destroy it. Very, very cool stuff. And so we found a mechanism, something that nature has been doing all the time. And these things, this is why I think these are sentient, they're intelligent. You know, we create the greatest debris trails of any organism on the planet. And these things are running behind us trying to help and trying to fix the environment, you know, to repair it.
Paul Stamets' research has also identified strains of mushrooms that break down petrochemical and other biohazardous substances. Pioneers note that displayed everywhere around us is the genius of 3.5 billion years of evolution. Our ancestors looked to the wisdom of the earth for the instructions for survival. It is only in our recent history as a species that we have turned away from the libraries of life found so readily in the forests, mountains, deserts, waters, and air. It seems that we've become fascinated with co-evolving with ourselves. The mirror of cleverness presenting our creative entertainments and distractions has become so magnetic and brilliant that many warn of a growing blindness. Terry Tempest Williams is the former naturalist in residence at the Utah Museum of Natural History in Salt Lake City. She's the author of numerous books, including the critically acclaimed Leap, Refuge, and An Unspoken Hunger. She is a writer who still draws inspiration from the mysterious miracle of the living earth, from Gaia.
Our family every year goes to California for a family vacation, usually in August. And we take our nieces, and it's a whole extended family of aunts, uncles, cousins, and grandparents. And it was the last night, and my father was really saying, you know, this younger generation, I just can't believe they have to go to movies every minute, they have to go to malls every minute. You know, what's the world coming to? And he said, nothing will satisfy their hunger. And I could see his point, but it's you know, Dad, they're 14, they're 16, they're good kids. You know, it's those typical family discussions that you have behind closed doors or around the dinner table. Well, it was the last night, and we built a fire on the beach, and we were just sitting there talking, and we were eating, and all of a sudden, the moon came up, and the surf, and maybe this is commonplace to you Californians, but the surf was just electric green. And we all thought, you know, what are we drinking? What's in our food? And the girls just went, wait a minute, did you see that? And my father said nothing. You know, oh, you're just imagining it's the floodlights. And they said, no, did you see it again as another wave broke? And my father started rubbing his eyes. And before we could even think, we were all down at the water's edge in the surf. The waves were breaking over us. We were out We were really in the water to our shoulders, just screaming. It was this beautiful phosphorescent tide. Everywhere you swept your hand, it was magic. The girls wanted to know about dinoflagellates. They wanted to know about bioluminescence. I mean, we could never have had this discussion if they weren't literally being baptized in those magical waves. And I thought, you know, Steven Spielberg can't touch one night of a phosphorescent tide. That sense of wonder, it's what makes us human.
The sense of wonder, the sense of connection to all of life. These pioneers report that humans are a part of nature, not apart from it. They call us to taste the richness of this coevolutionary journey and restore Gaia to her place in our hearts. Gaian Wonders of the Coevolutionary Dance. To find out more about the work and writings of Stephen Foster, Jeremy Narby, Jennifer Green, Peter Warshaw, Paul Stamets, Terry Tempest Williams, and all of the participants in this series, the annual Bioneers Conference, and membership information, call the Collective Heritage Institute, toll-free, at 1-877-BIONEER. That's 1-877-246-6337. Or visit the Bioneers website by directing your browser to www.bioneers.org. Special thanks to Ron Sunsinger at Sunsinger Sound, Sarah Bauman, and to Conference Recording Services Richard Page and Michael Brandt for conference recordings. The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature, is a production of New Dimensions Radio, distribution by the New Dimensions Broadcasting Network. Executive Producer, Michael Toms. Producer, Neil Harvey. Managing Producer, Justine Willis-Toms. Associate Producers, Catherine Vibert, Jeff Westman, and Rose Holland. Media Relations and Distribution, Giovanna Perrine and Christina Fleming. Our theme music is taken from the album Journey Between by Baka Bian and used by permission of Hannibal Records, a record disc label. My name is Michael Toms. On behalf of everyone at the New Dimensions Broadcasting Network, I'm wishing you well. This is program number 2875.